Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are the dynamic duo, John Lindemann and James Jones.
Wait, what?
You have a special bond, so I figured I would just let you introduce you two together.
We do have a special bond, I'll admit that.
And Greg Leahy is here too, our esteemed podcast editor.
Hoi hoi, everyone.
It's like Hitler playing golf with Netanyahu. There.
We're all here.
Johnny Metz and his rowdy friends.
Oh.
They all came over the internet tonight.
Oh. Are you ready for some football?
Not anymore, apparently. You're fired, son.
If that ain't country, I'll kiss your ass. All right. Yeah. Yes, we are here for the podcast, people. It's episode 263 of Radio Free Nintendo, and we've got a dynamite show lined up for you today. Lots of excellent listener mails coming up in the second part. We've got a retroactive winner to announce at the end of the show. But first up is new business, and Greg's going to kick it off.
Yep. So I've been playing Cat Trap, the virtual console release from last week in Europe. I think it's this week in America.
It is, but Greg, we have to resolve this. Are you sure it's Cat Trap, or could it be Cat Rap?
Who knows, but I would go with
Cat Trap.
Being a portmanteau of cat and trap, I will go with Cat Trap.
Tell you what, I'll submit a query to Nintendo PR and we'll hear back. Never.
I feel uneasy about this, but please go on.
Yeah, let's keep going. So, I think the last time, or perhaps any time that this particular game has been mentioned on the show before was in a kind of unkind way in a stinger where Chris Kohler was adding a vowel to the end of the name.
Well, Neil might have brought it up maybe it was on the live show, but I know that Neil Ronahan, our esteemed website director, his wife, now they just got married, so now his wife, Lauren, is a huge, huge fan of Cat Trap, and I don't know how she came upon it many years ago, but I'm sure she'll be thrilled that this is on 3DS now.
Yeah, so that was the first time I heard of this game. It was back when we did the feature on the website about games that we want to see on the virtual console, virtual handheld. I think it was back in February. Lauren had Cat Trap as her pick, and I'd never heard of it. One of the few in the list, really, that I hadn't heard of, even though I hadn't played many of them because I didn't own a Game Boy back in the day. But it kind of piqued my interest back then, and then it came out quite a while ago in Japan, I think, under the Pitman name, which is its original name.
How do you go from Pitman to Cat Trap?
Yeah, explain
is
that.
Is it Pitman or Pitman?
Pitman.
Or Pitnom. I got it in Pitnom.
Podcast is over.
So it was originally called Pitman when it was a computer game, and its origins are as a Japanese computer game for about 1985. And
wow.
So it was like ported to the Game Boy in Japan, with the only kind of difference, really, I guess, being that instead of just like a sort of generic stick figure kind of character, they made these little, you know, anthropomorphic cat people. And then that kind of fed into the name when they brought it over to America. And so that's how Pitman became Cat Trap, basically. But, yeah, it's actually just sort of an environmental puzzle game where your object of each level, you get you've got 100 levels in the game. There are these little environmental challenges where the goal is simply to bump into every enemy on screen. But of course, you've got all these like movable blocks and destructible terrain, all this kind of stuff that you have to do everything in the right sequence to make it possible for you to kill all those enemies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it starts off real simple. And then, you know, certainly I've done more than half of the puzzles now. I think that's most of the low hanging fruit taken out. And there's some real head scratches at this point. And the cool thing is that you've just got the whole menu of 100. Well, technically the whole menu of 99 available to you, and you could pick the 99th one first if you wanted. But if you want to play the very final level, which has a couple of question marks on it, I think you have to have completed everything else. But other than that, it's free reign, kind of like Bangai of Spirits or something. So you could just kind of, if there's a particular puzzle that you're struggling with, you could just pick another one. And there's some blocks of ones that actually are significantly different, because normally you just pick between either like the cat boy or the cat girl, but there is no difference, as you might expect. It's just...
Well, there's one very important difference.
Yeah, well, I don't think the Game Boy's graphics is able to render such a difference under the hood, as it were. But it's...
I'm out.
It's a hardware issue, if you will.
No, I won't.
Where the two characters thing comes into play is you get blocks of levels where you actually play as both characters and you press the select button to switch between them. So you kind of, as John coined the phrase last week, you're cooperating with yourself. And it is fun. Actually, those are my favorite levels in a game, where you actually have to use both characters. Another variable, you know, I mean, the levels are not terribly different. You know, I mean, they each offer a challenge, but a lot of them have similar concepts, maybe just a bit more intricate, a few more blocks, a few more enemies involved as it goes on. But these are, you know, substantively different. So they're pretty cool. I think they must make up something like about a third of the levels in the game or something, just roughly. So they're nice. And the big sort of, what must have been very forward thinking, I guess, back in 85, is the fact that you can actually undo moves with a press of the B button, I think it is. So obviously the whole thing is that you've got to be done in a very specific sequence, especially the more complex puzzles. So yeah, if you get so far into a sequence, even just like a careless stroke of the D-pad to like destroy a little bit of scenery that like causes a block to fall and screw it up, you know, that would be really annoying if you have to just restart it. With here, you could just hold the B button for a while and undo that, and you could press like the A button if you want to sort of fast forward it again a few moves, or you know, you could kind of just go back and forward however you like. And so it definitely makes the whole process of experimentation with how to solve these things a lot less painful than it would be if you were just restarting all the time.
That sounds great, actually.
You could just sort of break it down almost algorithmically, like, okay, let me try this move. Okay, well, if I try that move, there's no way I can solve it. So we can rule that out. Let's wind back and start over. You know, not so much on the more complicated ones, you'd be there all day if you were that robotic about it. But certainly, you know, at a certain point, you can be that specific with it. So that's a really cool feature that certainly, you know, was ahead of its time in 1990 as well when it came out of the Game Boy. But this is another case, actually, I did want to mention, of, I think, basically an import game not being called an import game for the PAL virtual console for the European region, because as far as I'm aware, there was not an official release for Cat Trap in Europe. So I've heard accounts of people that saw this like included on like dodgy pirate cartridges that, you know, have like a million games on them or something, and this is one of them, but not like an official release. And more interestingly, something I found out through hardcoregaming101.net, there's people have got scans of a magazine review of this game in the UK market from about 1994, and it's called like Paw Power or something, like something with paws in the title instead of cat.
God.
Right? But then no one can ever confirm that it actually came out. It was reviewed, but that we have no idea. But the point is, I mean, with this virtual console release, it just says Cat Trap 1990, which seems very unlikely that it ever came out under that name in Europe in 1990. So in addition to the situation with Gargoyle's Quest, where I couldn't really confirm whether it came out officially in the UK anyway.
What the hell happened in the Europe?
Well, it was scattershot back then, that's the thing. So it's nice, though, that they're putting these things up, you know, without a premium on them, if they also came out in America anyway. I mean, whether we'll get, you know, Japan exclusive stuff in the future with, right, you know, an import premium attached to it, that might happen maybe. But for at least with this sort of Western stuff, they're kind of sticking to the old Game Boy philosophy of kind of keeping it region free almost, by not having a tag on it. And also, this particular game, Cat Trap, is at the $3/€/£2.70 price level. You know, it's the sort of lesser price level, which is good value for the amount of content. I mean, in terms of, it's not a big IP, or the aesthetics and the music, or I've just played it with the sound off. I can only imagine, you know, I don't think there's a lot of musical variety, so I'm sure that would grate after a while. And there's pretty much no aesthetic variety or anything, you know, so it doesn't exactly exude huge production values. But in terms of the amount of gameplay there, I mean, I think this is going to prove to be really a good value for under £3.
And you're enjoying it, most importantly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of thing I really like on this sort of format, where you can just flip it open, ponder a puzzle for a little while. Maybe you do it and then close it back up, or you just pick another one from the entire list of 100. I mean, it's just there at your fingertips, total flexibility. You don't have to look at it for more than a minute if you don't want to, but at the same time, you can get on a bit of a tear and start solving a bunch of them at a time for half an hour, if you like. I mean, it's really cool, portable virtual console game. Again, sort of like, you know, not the same as Game & Watch, literally, because that's a high score thing, but it's another sort of thing that, for me, is just far, far more satisfying and far more likely to get that use out of it in this sort of easy access portable format than you would in any other.
Yeah, that sounds excellent. I might pick that up. Unfortunately, I just checked my eShop account before we started recording. I think my wallet or whatever it's called, my account has like $2.73 on it.
That's how they get you.
From leftovers, you know, built up over other things. So I'm going to have to add money to get this. But I do like this kind of a puzzle game. And if you say it's a good value and there's a good variety and it's satisfying and it's challenging and also you're not going to play up to a point and get stuck because you can always go and just select a different level, that sounds like a really good mix.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the one thing with the variety is it's going to be how that holds up once you just play like some of the really harder ones over the long, you know, which are going to take longer to solve probably. Later on is, you know, a bit more questionable, like, but you do have the ones with the two characters, so at least you've got that. But I think there's enough variety, certainly, to sort of get into the game. And then I guess it's a question of how much you enjoy it. Are you going to be sort of committed to trying to solve every puzzle or some of the really tricky ones? Because definitely, I think like after the first 20 are pretty gentle, but after that, there's some that are kind of weirdly simple here and there, but there's not too many that are complete pushovers after 20.
Have you seen any sort of like trick where you can use the same kind of technique to solve a bunch of different puzzles?
Oh, you'll definitely carry over certain ideas.
Yeah.
You know, once you see one sort of level, you think, yeah, you know, this is sort of like what I did before, you know, in terms of, you know, arranging the blocks or like how you can, you know, sort of use the ladders differently, maybe to like skip under a block here and then kick it out from the side or like, you know, you will learn things that are going to come in handy, but of course you then apply them to more complex scenarios as it goes on.
Very cool.
So, Greg, will you be getting golf since that's your only choice this week, apparently?
I don't think I'll be getting golf. I'm pretty confident that...
What happened?
That I do like my video game golf. I'm still playing Mario Golf for GBA, which is, I'm pretty confident is probably the superior portable golf game.
It is!
And if you want retro, you've got the NES Open Tournament Golf on the Ambassador program anyway. So, yeah, that's a pretty hard sell.
There's already plenty of golf games on the platform. Let's put out another one. And make that the only thing we release this week. What the hell?
If that had a chance to sell some significant amount of copies, I think it needed to come out sooner.
It needed to be the first day.
You know, Metroid 2 is still not out in the West. That's kind of odd. It's been out for a couple of weeks at least in Japan. I expect it will be out sooner.
Yeah, the European release schedule commits it for it to come out before the end of the year. And okay. I would imagine that as soon as we get it, America will either be getting it the same week or a week out, or, you know, it'll be close.
Yeah, well, if you want to prepare for Metroid 2, if you've never played it, it is, James hates it, but it is a very interesting...
Because it's fucking broken!
...flawed and fascinating Game Boy game. We did a pretty extensive look at it in Retroactive a couple years ago, and I would highly recommend you go back and find that episode, and we'll maybe put a link to it in the show notes for this one so you can find it easily. But even if you don't want to play it, you might get a kick out of hearing James bitch about it, because it's a tough game. I mean, it's a hard game to love.
It's not tough. Tough implies that it's difficult fairly. It's
broken.
Well,
it's a weird fit for the platform. Maybe a poor fit, you might even say.
No,
I think it's a
misfit.
Really good game that doesn't fit very well on the platform, but I think it's totally worth playing. So anyway, we probably won't be talking about it when it comes out because we all played it in the past couple of years, you know, but I'm sure a lot of other people will be talking about it whenever it does come out on Virtual Console. And I think for a lot of people, if you're a Metroid fan especially, I think it is worth checking out. It's a really interesting little piece of history, and it, in some ways it's a very enjoyable game. It's in some ways it's very infuriating as well, but you take the bad with the good. Okay, well, James is up next.
Yeah, so I bit off the second half of Solitaire Robo. I actually plan on the review being up right now, but it'll be up by the time this episode gets out, presumably. Last week, I was pretty hard on the game. I felt like the game was boring just for the sake of being boring. Like, it was doing things seemingly designed to mock you with how boring they are.
Sounds like No More Heroes in between the fighting bits.
A little bit. I mean, the example I cited was that there were multiple instances of forkliftery. And the game basically being split literally in two halves. I'd pretty much finished the first half last week, and I went through the second half this week. And it does improve substantially in that regard in the second half. The quests that you can take become better. Generally speaking, there's less, can you go talk to this kid, he stole my doll? And more like, can you go engage in a battle with 50 pirates on the deck of a ship and guns? Some of the ones that came in late in the second half are infuriating, both because sometimes the platforming could be a little weird because of the camera angle. The camera angle is by and large fixed, but it pans. So it doesn't move in three dimensions. It just sort of moves along with you. And sometimes that can lead to some awkward jumping. And a lot of these like timed platforming levels, that can be kind of a problem. I think the game picked up pace a lot better in the second half, and it's just generally a more interesting game in the second half of the game. It still isn't quite what I was hoping for, and it's a tough review because there are things about the game that just made me want to not play this game. And in the end, even when the game got most interesting, I still wasn't able to play it for more than like an hour and a half. But there are parts of the game that are legitimately very good, beyond just the visuals, which obviously are really impressive. But it was a difficult, incredibly difficult process for writing this particular review, and I, like I said, I'm mentioning it because I feel better about the game now than I did a week ago.
Yeah.
But I'm not super high on it. It still isn't, you know, it never really got the hooks in, as it were, until I'd say maybe the very last 2 to 3 hours. And then I was in because the game started throwing variety at me, and if you could suffer that long, if you get through the first half, you'll really enjoy the second half.
Yeah. It's one of those, that's how I felt about, like, the end of Donkey Kong 64. The last level where all the Kongs work together to solve this big convoluted puzzle. I thought, wow, why couldn't the rest of the game been like this? This is what I expected from the beginning.
Right.
And they finally pulled it off, but for, you know, a tiny percentage of the whole game.
So I would say of the 20 hours I spent playing the game and clearing all but a handful of the quests, just because they're evil, I would say the last 3 hours are really, like, I was really locked in, and then the last 7 are pretty good payoff for the previous hours. But it's still a hard sell.
Now, did you get a chance to play Inazuma 11?
So, I mentioned a long time ago that the first phase of the European invasion to my home was Inazuma 11 on the DS, and it was immediately swept aside by everything else that came in. Either because I was obliged to get through those games quickly, or this game was Xenoblade Chronicles, and it's the only reason Inazuma 11 ever got here. So, since the backlog is clean now, I was able to finally really get into my...
I know what that feels like.
I was about to say something, I swear. I wish I knew what that felt like. I'm working on it.
You know, you beat a 20-hour game in 2 weeks, you get to find out what that feels like. First off, to discuss the game, and I've only played for a few hours, I don't have a whole lot to say, is that it really does have that almost Mario Tennis-y feel, where there's this RPG mode where you run around and talk to people and do stuff, find new teammates, find items, do things like that. And then there's the actual match mode, which is entirely stylus controlled. There's a lot of like telling your people where to go, and then just trying to get the ball upfield so you can take shots on goal. I mean, primarily that's the game, and a lot of it's basically just a bunch of one-on-one interactions with other opponents on the field, almost entirely decided by rock, paper, scissors, and levels.
Now, I take it that you picked up Inazuma 11 not because you're a huge soccer fan, but because you wanted to play a level 5 soccer RPG.
Two reasons. One, when we were at PAX East, Carly had it, and I watched her play, and it just seemed so completely, utterly absurd that it was like, okay.
That Carly and her PAX East wiles. I mean, she just gets people to buy games left, right, and center.
She bought it for Neil, because Neil asked for it, but she had already played most of it, and I actually watched a match, and there's like kids shooting dragons at each other and just explosions. It's like, you know what? Whatever. This is awesome.
This definitely sounds like something Neil would like, because I know he's really into, you know, Sega Soccer Slam, and he was really hyped up on that Ubisoft.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There is actually like a new game, where it's relatively new in Japan. It came out this year, Inazuma 11 Strikers, which is a lot more like Soccer Slam. Like the RPG stuff is kind of out, but it's, you know, cartoony kind of arcade soccer game with crazy special moves and all that kind of stuff. This isn't that much like a Soccer Slam kind of deal, because as you said, it's this weird stylus driven thing when you actually play matches. But that game, I don't know whether that would ever come to Europe and therefore sort of be it might be importable anyway, because it's more of just an arcade soccer game.
Yeah, you probably get away with not being able to read it.
I assume it's probably got a certain amount of dense kind of text, just because it's trying to tie into the same fiction.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I couldn't play this game in Japanese. I mean, I might know the word for library when it tells me to go there, but damned if I'm going to be able to make out things like go to the Riverside Park. I'd be like, that's the word for river. we're not doing well here. But the other reason I picked it up was that it's a level 5 RPG, and I enjoy level 5 games in general, and also that the game...
I was going to say, have you ever played a level 5 RPG?
I believe I have. I just can't think of one.
I've played a bunch, but I'm wondering...
I seem to recall that I have, but now I can't think of the specific...
Dark Cloud, maybe?
No.
Did you ever play Dark Cloud?
No. Well, regardless, it's a level 5 game in general, but the game has also spawned about 100,000 sequels in Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 2 or 3 more on the DS, and then there's the Strikers game for Wii that I mentioned, and then there's Inazuma 11 Go, which is going to come out on the 3DS, which has like a whole Pokemon-style dual versions thing going on.
Yeah, so in my head, it means that either Japan's really weird, which they are, but...
Yes. Quite like soccer as well.
Yeah, but that the game must at least at a base level be pretty good. Because, it can get through being eccentric, you know, densha to go. But it can't get through being eccentric 3 games in like 5 years.
Well, how big is that sport in Japan? How big is soccer in Japan?
Soccer is a big sport. I mean, it's probably a bit behind baseball in Japan, but
they did have the World Cup there, and they enjoyed it a lot. Yeah. I think there was more tangible enthusiasm than there was, say, in USA 94.
But I haven't gotten particularly far in it, but there is one thing I want to mention right off the bat, and that is because of this game, no one from England is allowed to ever make fun of any bad English accents ever. Because the main character in this game has the absolute worst voice acting of any character ever in anything.
Oh, it's got voice acting?
Yes.
Oh, I had no idea.
So the character who's been renamed Mark...
you sure that wasn't his original name?
He's been renamed Brad.
Yeah, I'm pretty...
Brad.
I think there is actually a Brad. There's like all these just really ridiculous renames. But... His voice is somewhere in this range. Oh, we need to figure out what we're doing today. Yes, we need to get to the field so we can practice.
That was Stallone. Jesus.
We need to get a sample on the show.
Stallone. It's so bad.
Stallone doing a British accent.
Every time he talks, I just start laughing.
I don't care. I don't stop here.
It sounds like the best thing I can describe it is it's almost close to the South Park character Butters with a bad Cockney accent. It's ridiculous. And presumably there's no one to blame in this because Nintendo of Europe is responsible for its localization. So.
I think James has stumbled into an astonishingly awesome word there. It's a sort of portmanteau of Cockney and Hackneyed. Cockneyed.
There we go. Perfect. It is unbelievably awful and kind of hilarious at the same time because he just... At the very beginning of the game when you start it up, he introduces the game as titled, Inazuma 11! And I just... Like, I wonder
if it's the same voice as it is in the actual cartoon that started showing.
I would suspect it is.
Yeah, maybe that's why it's so terrible. I don't know.
I don't know, because I would assume the cartoon's being localized in Europe, because I don't believe it's on television anywhere here.
Right, yeah.
It's so bad. It's amazing. I just... Oh, it was wonderful. It was you start the game up, and that's the... Well, first off, you hear the amazing opening intro. Basically, they took the Japanese opening jingle and then probably literally translated the words and then had somebody sing them all excited.
Always gold.
With children cheering in the background. It's it's absurd.
See, look, America, this is the dark side of Europe's willingness to localize things from Japan now. So we don't need Xenoblade. If this is the price we have to pay,
I've enjoyed the matches so far. They've been pretty easy. Unless the game is literally beating you because it's a story constraint.
Yeah.
Which isn't a lot of fun in a sports game. Like, in an RPG, in a regular RPG, you kind of expect...
It's not fun in an RPG either.
Yeah, but to an extent, you expect it a bit more. You're like, okay.
An unwinnable battle.
I am not hurting this guy. It probably is because I'm not supposed to win. But yeah. in a soccer or football, and that's how they call it this game, if you can't get to the goal, you just think it's because you suck. Especially if it's the very first match. It's like, am I just really bad at this? Or am I supposed to lose? And then at halftime, they just cut to halftime, and it's 20-0. Like, all right, I wasn't losing that bad. Come on, game. I will say one more comment about the game, and I'll talk about it more when I have time with it, is that how you level up is random battles where you're challenged by in 4-on-4 matches by other clubs in the school. So I'm getting really tired of having to score the first goal against the chess club just at random as I'm walking around the school campus. It is an utterly strange story constraint that I have yet to find an explanation for. But when a member of the athletics club does something called death slide against another junior high school student, it's a bit out of place.
Well, it sounds pretty promising, actually.
It's a joyously weird game.
We received good reviews when it came out in Europe. One of the main criticisms actually was that some of the latter games in the series that are already out in Japan are a bit more refined.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if this is the only one that we get in this market here, given that we are so much at the end of the DS's life, it might be difficult to localize other DS games at this point, then that'd be a bit of a shame. But I guess they felt they had to come in at the beginning with the story.
Yeah, especially since apparently at least the UK release is somewhat tied to the release of or the beginning of the airing of the TV show.
Yeah, that's why we had that. Remember, I remarked about the bizarre situation where it was released but not released.
Yep.
That I think that was pretty much why is they had released it across Europe but held it back at the very last minute in the UK because they decided to reconsider and let it be more closely synchronized with the beginning of the anime being shown on one of the kids' channels.
And it wouldn't surprise me in the least if like the story matches in this game literally sync up to episodes of the anime.
Yeah.
But I've enjoyed the 3 or so hours I've played. I got stuck in a time sink with it for a little while because I was trying to figure out why I can't get a shot on goal. But beyond that, it seems pretty good. We'll see how I feel about it when 3 hours turns into 13 though.
All right, cool. So that's Inazuma 11 and John is up next.
Yeah, I'm still playing through Demon's Souls. I've been pretty busy this week, so I haven't really had much time to do anything else, but I managed to put a couple hours in and moved on to the next boss, which is the Tower Knight, who is the second boss. Pretty much when you fight him, you come out into this huge, like, walled area. And the first thing is you have to climb up to the top of the walls and shoot him from the top of the walls, effectively. And so I'm a mage-ish kind of character. I didn't go for a warrior or anything like that. Which allows me to, you know, I actually killed him quite easily. I mean, it's the kind of game where it really is like, you know, some kind of like 8-bit platformer where, you know, like the first time you play it, you might make a quarter of the way through an area. Then you'll make it halfway after, you know, several more attempts. And then you'll make it 3/4 of a way through. And then eventually you'll make it all the way to the boss. But before you get to the boss, you'll die a couple times right before the boss.
It sounds like a perfect candidate for Game Center CX.
Yeah, I can see it could definitely fit in there. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward game. It doesn't really, the thing is, there's a lot of things you can do with your character because you actually like you collect souls, like as you kill monsters. And there's an element where you can grind for souls because souls are effectively the currency in the game. You can buy stuff with them. You can also use it to increase the stats on your character. So there's a lot of thought that goes into making your character build, like, you know, what kind of character do you want to to create? You know, do you want a guy that attacks from range, or do you want, you know, something, a guy who usually, who can use spells and heal himself? So, you know, in that sense, it is a true RPG in the sense that you build your character and you see him progress over time.
Well, I think you're brave for playing Demon's Souls. I tried it and said, well, this is not for me. But actually, in the comments thread, the talk back for last week's episode, some people thought that this is a game that Greg or maybe James would really like a lot.
Yeah, it's a weird one for me because there's elements of it that sound like, you know, that John spoke to some of its old school sort of tendencies and its sort of almost clockwork-like nature with the dependability of things. That sounds like an 8-bit action game. But the RPG elements, I'm actually quite rubbish at RPGs. Mm-hmm. And I think it's mainly because I don't have the patience required for them when they're difficult.
This is the guy who beat Ghosts and Goblins or Ghouls and
Ghosts. Yeah, exactly. That's the point. Is that I have infinite patience for that sort of game. Yeah. And for whatever reason, it's just a psychological quirk. You know, for RPGs, my patience is less. It's just the way it is.
That's the thing. I mean, this is, I would call it an RPG, but it's more, I don't know, sort of a...
It is an action RPG. I mean, it's all real-time battles and everything.
It's more action-oriented, definitely. I mean, and the thing is, what's cool is that there are different approaches that you can take to different areas of the game. Like, for example, one of the first areas of the game, you kind of go across a bridge. And so there's two kind of ways you can go across. You can just run across, but of course, there is a big monster that comes through and breathing fire, and he flies down, and, you know, he keeps doing that, like in a loop.
Oh, yeah, that's where I quit that game.
Yeah, so you have to, and the thing is, you have to run across. You have to run across, and you have to figure out that you have to take off your armor to make yourself light enough to actually run fast enough, right? So once you, the thing is, and once
so
you...
So wait, the game tells you you have to strip to win.
Oh, no.
The game doesn't tell you anything.
It doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't tell you a damn thing.
So the game is only winnable by nudists, is what you're telling me, and perverts. So congratulations, John.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of drawing me in slowly. Like, there's been times where I've been like, ah, whatever.
John's all about the stripping. It's fine.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like one of those things where you think about it because you know it's not going to change. It's not going to change. I mean, the monsters are going to be in the same place doing the same things. And you're like, well, you know, I couldn't do that, but maybe if I did this. So maybe I'll just try it one more time. And it just keeps doing that. Like, that's what it does to you. That's how it sucks you in. It's that kind of that element of maybe if I just tried wearing this armor, maybe if I was a bit faster, or maybe if I cashed in some souls and maybe upped my magic or something like that. All these little like tweaks you can make and just kind of things that you can do. So even though you'll die a lot.
Yeah, see, that's part of it for me. I think the difference psychologically between the two kinds of games is I like it when, you know, something like Ghosts and Goblins or Castlevania, so I know I've got everything I need.
Yeah.
I don't have to think about whether I need to upgrade this stat or get better. It's like, you know, you've got the basic attacks all there. You've just got to get better. You've just got to execute. You know, that I could sort of get behind the sort of tinkering and that's where I lose patience. Which is perfectly valid game design. It's just something about my personality is not amenable to it.
Well, the other issue for Greg, I think, is that this game's a massive time sink. I mean, you know, there's stories of people who play Demon's Souls for hundreds of hours.
That's I mean, I've been making good progress in Xenoblade, and I think, again, as I already mentioned it, it's because it is quite easy, and you just feel like you will achieve something when you play it for a while. So, like, you know, whereas with that game, I would have like, okay, I've got, you know, maybe an hour to 90 minutes to spare, and I could play it and think, like, well, that was productive, wasn't it? You know, nothing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're...
That leaves a bad taste in your mouth, doesn't it? That sort of thing. I mean, that's how people do end up, like, stopping playing games, if they play it for a while and feel like they got nothing out of it.
Yeah, right? there's been some times where I've sat there for a couple of hours, and I have gotten nothing out of it. Like, I have in the sense of, like, yeah, you know, I've gotten some souls so I can, you know, up some stats or whatever. But in terms of making progress, like beating the next boss, nothing. I don't look at it like a game that I'm trying to power through. I look at it like kind of like a long-term sort of just chip away at it.
It's a project.
Yeah.
I could see me maybe picking up Dark Souls, or God forbid if they do a third one or whatever.
Darkest Souls.
One day when I stop editing the show and I've got more time to dedicate to such things.
So never.
So I would compare this game a bit to like Armored Core games where, you know, all right, you need to go tweak your balancing on this mech and try this level again.
It's the same developer. Yeah, it's From Software.
From Software, yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. There's your
yeah,
reasoning.
There you go. That's
it's,
it. Yep.
It's just absolutely obsessive. All right, let me go buy this stabilizer and try it out on my right shoulder and see what happens.
All right. Well, I will wrap up new business. I've got a few things, actually. Since Greg brought up Xenoblade, I'll just say I played about an hour of it. I really liked it. And I decided that because this is going to be a big game and it will take a long time for me to get through, especially with, you know, diversions into Batman and Uncharted and other things, Zelda, that are coming out this fall, I kind of decided that I didn't want to get real deep into Xenoblade before I finished a few other things. And so the past week, I spent playing a lot of games that I've started earlier and that I really wanted to complete, and I did complete a couple of them. So first off, I'll talk about Rochard. This is a game I talked about last week. It's not a very long game. It's like 5 hours or so. It's a download $10 thing from PlayStation Network, but I did finish that last night, and it got really cool towards the end. There was some, they sort of added a couple new mechanics that were really fun. One of them is just a blatant tribute to Super Metroid with the grappling beam. There's a mechanic where you use your gravity gun type thing to sort of swing around certain objects in the environment, and it controls a little better than the grappling beam in Super Metroid, but it works pretty much the same way. It's really fun to use, and then you get a kind of a, you get an offensive capability. I don't want to spoil it in case anybody wants to check this game out, but you get a really empowering ability in combat right at the very end of the game. You don't use it for very long, but you don't need to, because it makes you so powerful. It's kind of like getting the screw attack in Metroid, you know, where all of a sudden it's like, okay, nothing's...
Is it a mask that turns you into a god?
No, but it's a kind of thing like screw attack where it's like, once you get that, you know that there's probably nothing in the game that's going to stand up to you except for a boss that's immune to it. So it makes sense that it's like pretty much the last thing that you get. But yeah, Rochard is really cool, and I was playing it, I kept thinking that this would be really good for a portable experience, because it is very much a, it's something that's pretty easy to play in bite-sized chunks. It's a limited scope kind of game. It's not like a really grand adventure. Actually, the story is really absurd and kind of terrible. The voice acting is really bad. The main character is played by John St. John of Duke Nukem fame.
Perfect. So,
yeah, doing his best trucker voice. The story is pretty awful. The writing and the voice acting are pretty bad. But the presentation graphically, I really like. The music's pretty good too, but the graphical presentation I really like, because, you know, it's a 2D game. It's all made of polygons. It's high definition, but it's a 2D game. And the levels have this sort of sense of depth to the environment, you know, because it's like they used to call it 2.5D back in the like 32-bit era, you know, but, it's kind of like Klonoa, maybe. That's a good reference point, where you've got, you know, 3D objects, you've got the camera. The camera never really, like, rotates around the character, but it does sometimes zoom in and out a little bit. But the coolest part is that you've got a nice sense of depth in the backgrounds, and sometimes, you know, you'll get to a certain place where you can see way into the background. You get the sense that this environment is much larger than the little strip that you can actually walk across. But then they also put objects in the foreground, and that's something I haven't seen very much in this kind of a 2D game, is that they have these objects that are, you know, they'll just be, maybe be pipes or little overhanging bits of structure, maybe a ladder, and it's not something you can interact with, but it's basically between your point of view and where, and the plane that the character moves around on. And it has this nice depth of field effect where it's kind of blurry because you're not focused on that, right? You know, it's too close for you to focus on, so you're looking past it so you can see the character. And it's not, you know, they don't do it in like really important places where it would be obstructive. It's just kind of like a nice little thing it's like a little flair that they add on there to make the game look cooler, and it gives you a better sense that you're in this real environment that has volume, even though it's a 2D game. And I thought this would look fantastic on 3DS, you know, with that sense of there being something between you and the character.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this game's published by Sony, so I don't think you're going to see that happen anytime soon. But a game like that, a game that used that kind of effect, I think would be really cool. And it's one of the answers, I think, to putting a 2D gameplay experience on 3DS and actually making good use of the 3D graphics. And maybe we'll see some of that in Cave Story 3D, for instance. It's a possibility. We'll have to see more of that game and see how they pull that into it. But I thought it looked really cool, even on a 2D display, my TV.
But yeah, Rochard is a really cool game. It's like I said, it's not super long, but it's very reasonably priced. And I think if you like sort of physics-based puzzle platforming type games, it's one of the best examples in that genre. I also put a fair bit of time into Eco. This is, you know, it's on the HD collection. I got it with Shadow of the Colossus, and it's going to take me a while to get through these games because I do have other things that I'm sort of playing at the same time. So I'm not trying to rush through it or anything. And Eco is a game that, to me, you shouldn't rush through it because it's a very slow-paced game. It's very atmospheric. For instance, there's virtually no music in it whatsoever except when you're at the save menu. It's just all ambient sounds, and you hear the girl, Yorda, she kind of grunts, or, you know, she makes sounds as you drag her around these worlds. And Eco is interesting, I think, from a historical point of view, in that it's a very influential game. I've talked about it before, how it's affected a lot of other things that came since it. But as I'm playing it now, I'm getting more of a sense of how, in some ways, it's very influenced by Zelda, and by 3D Zelda, like Ocarina of Time, in how you push boxes around to sort of solve, you know, how do I get from point A to point B, or how do I activate this switch, and how do I keep it activated, how do I keep it pressed so that I can continue on through the door. And in some cases, I think it's informed a lot of later Zelda games, you know, like in Wind Waker, where you have this other character you can sort of guide around. In Spirit Tracks, it's a huge, I mean, absolutely huge, how you sort of, I mean, in Spirit Tracks, it's more discreet in that you give the other character a path. You know, you sort of give them orders, the statue that Zelda inhabits. You give her orders and commands, and she goes and does the thing. But in terms of, like, puzzle solving, in which you actually use two different characters, and eventually you do have to get both characters through the door in order to move on. And that's a huge, that's pretty much the crux of what Eco is all about. You know, you can split up from Yorda, you can go off and do your own thing because she's really helpless and you don't want to have to babysit her quite so closely. So you can sort of leave her in a seemingly safe place and go do other things. But in order to move on, you have to go grab her and figure out a way to get her across this gap that she won't jump over. Which means you're going to have to go around a different way or open up a bridge so that she can get across it. It's all about that, and I think it has played into Zelda quite a bit, as well as a whole bunch of other games. Really interesting use of AI, and it's really good at developing the sense that you're really the caretaker for this person and that you're really responsible for her. And when bad things happen to her, it kind of hits you emotionally to a surprising degree. You know, you might not be thinking about how attached you are to this character and how you really care about getting her through this dangerous place, but when certain events happen, it really hits you, and it might surprise you how much you have invested in this sort of unspoken character relationship that's happening in the game. Eco is really fascinating, and it's fun too, although not in a super satisfying, you know, really action-y way. It's more of a puzzle game. It's very slow-paced, like I said. But it's really good stuff, and I do think the HD collection is a massive improvement, because I played this game less than a year ago, I think, on PS2. I was borrowing it from Andy, and I talked about it a little bit on the show, and I never ended up getting more than a couple hours into it, and part of the reason is that on PS2, that game is just so blurry. It's kind of hard to look at, actually. And you get a sense that the environments they develop for it are really big and beautiful, and the camera moves in a really dynamic way, but the rendering engine that they had in those early days of PS2 it didn't display the game very well. And so the HD collection, other than just simply being in high definition, they've just kind of cleaned it up a lot. They've just given it a pass where it actually looks like a modern game now, and it looks nice and clean and really, really good lighting effects, and the animations have always been impressive. So I'm really enjoying that, and I watched some of the documentaries that are on the disc for Shadow of the Colossus, and it looks like that game holds up remarkably well. And it was a really late PS2 game, and that came out in 2005, around the time of the Xbox 360 launch. But the HD sort of reimagining that they've done on it looks fantastic, and I can't wait to play that, because that game is much more like Zelda than Eco. It is very directly comparable to Zelda, and I think is, from a couple things we know about Skyward Sword, has probably been an influence on Zelda at this point. So it goes both ways, and I'm really enjoying playing through these games. I think if you're a really big Zelda fan and you have a PS3, it's very much worth checking this out, and it's a good price, and you get two great games for it.
I think I might pick it up eventually. I'll get around to it.
Yeah, it's certainly on my list, definitely.
How long is that list, John?
It's very long. I just really don't need it right now. But it definitely, like, I have never played Eco, and definitely I want to see Shadow in HD for sure, because I haven't beaten that either, which I'm sure surprises nobody here. But yeah, I want to beat that at some point. It's on quote unquote the list.
Yeah, and I think I'm looking forward to playing through Shadow again, because I did play it and I did beat it when it was fairly new. A friend of mine bought it and I sort of borrowed it from him and played all the way through it, and I really liked it at the time. But even back then, even back in 2005, maybe early 2006, I could tell that that game had serious frame rate problems that in some cases made it a little bit difficult to play, actually, like really affected it. And it's not, when you see what it was pushing around on the PS2, it's not surprising. I mean, it's just super ambitious. The scope of that game is incredible. The size of the environments and the characters, these monsters that you're riding around on is really, really impressive. And apparently in the HD remake, they have totally locked down the frame rate in that game. And I think that alone will make it a lot more enjoyable to play through. And Greg, I think you would love these games. So, you know, when you get a chance. Yeah. I mean, the scary thing about it, even for me, is that although it's quite affordable, it's like $40, it's two games. And they're like action adventure games. They're not short.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, man, this is not helping my pile, you know?
Join the club, baby.
Yeah, fill it up, right. And lastly, I can report on another game that, like Rochard, I cleaned off the plate and I am now finished with, at least for a good while, and that's Portal 2. And, you know, I've talked about Portal 2 earlier in the year when it came out back in April, and I loved it, and I have now gone back. I played about half the co-op mode with a listener of ours named Synaptic. We met him back at PAX East in March. So I had a really good time playing through the co-op with him, but I only got to play about half of it because he'd already done part of it, and then we didn't have time to finish the last level. So I got a call from a friend, my friend Kevin. He's been on the show before a long time ago. He sort of had a free weekend, and I did too. And he said, hey, do you want to play through Portal 2 co-op? And I said, absolutely. I've been wanting to go back to it for a while. It was a perfect opportunity. So we played through the parts that I had skipped earlier, which was like the first two sections out of five. And then we went ahead and played the last one, the fifth one that I hadn't done either. And had a great time with all that. And then the peer review DLC pack came out, which is mostly co-op. There's the single player stuff is just a challenge mode tacked on for the parts that were already in the game. So it's not really new content. It's just kind of like it adds leaderboards, basically. I'm not interested in that. But it added a whole new campaign for co-op, which is, I guess, roughly an hour long. It depends on how quickly you solve the puzzles. But it's decent in size, I think, and it's free. So we ended up, we beat the co-op that comes on the disc, and then we beat the DLC too. And just had a fantastic time. And I don't play co-op games all that often. I kind of wish that I did it more often because it is a really great experience. But I think in Portal 2, it's really kind of the pinnacle of the online co-op experience. And it does have a split screen too on PlayStation or Xbox. But the amazing thing about playing through Portal 2 co-op is that you constantly get the sense that these are puzzles that were, you know, these levels that we're completing together are levels that you simply could not do by yourself. I mean, they're designed specifically for co-op, and they have to be, because there's just the complexity of what's going on and the crazy stuff that you're doing. I mean, you have four portals total when you play co-op, so you're just doing all this insane, mind-bending stuff that you just couldn't even imagine if you only played through the single player, because you just have so much more capability. And the communication aspect is really key. We started out trying to do voice chat through Steam, and that was horrible. I mean, really terrible. It's like almost as bad as WeSpeak. So I brought over the laptop, and we hooked up Skype, and we just used that instead. And it was far, far better.
That's
experience.
Sad.
It is sad. It really is. But you have to have voice chat to play this game. I mean, I just can't imagine doing it without that, because the coordination that you're pulling off is so complex. Sometimes it's timing. Sometimes it's just like, I need you to put your portal right here, or
hey,
this is not going to work, you know, or it's just a couple pixels off to the side. But it's a fantastic game. I think Portal 2 is probably my game of the year so far. But there's a lot more to go. Something could certainly surpass it. But, you know, I just think if you're interested in puzzle games, if you're interested in just unique experiences, Portal 2 is really, and it's a fantastic value too. I mean, right now on Steam,
you can get super cheap now.
It's like $30, I think. And it's a long game. I mean, the single player is at least 6 or 8 hours long. And then the co-op is just as long as that, and it's completely unique in addition to the single-player campaign. So I mean, this game is like orders of magnitude more beefy than the original Portal.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it for sale on Amazon for PS3 for like $35, probably less than that.
Oh, dude, it's so
$30 maybe?
Yeah, if you have something you can play Portal 2 on, I think you should give it a shot. It's a really, really fantastic game. All right, now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. We begin this week with reviews, quite a lot of reviews, in fact. First of all, we have the two reviews of Gaijin Games Bit Trip compilation, so Complete for Wii by Andrew Brown, and Saga for 3DS by our own James Jones. So you can read both of those articles to help you decide which version of the old-school WiiWare games is best for you. And we also have a double review from Neil Ronahan of the two versions of Skylanders Spyro's Adventure. So that's for Wii and 3DS. And Neil has many positive things to say about both versions, which he remarks that depth, breadth, and excellence are the name of the game in this Spyro reboot.
We have yet another review from Neil, this time for the 3DS version of Spider-Man Edge of Time, which he describes as containing switch flipping, robot battles, and monotony.
Not so positive.
Maybe I should give a mea culpa here. I kind of said this might be a game to look forward to last week, and that was about 12 hours before the review started rolling in, and unfortunately nobody has a whole lot good to say about Edge of Time.
Your spider sense should have been tickling, Johnny. We also have impressions for Pokemon Rumble Blast for 3DS. Get ready to Pokemon Rumble once again in the retail sequel to the 2009 WiiWare original. It's Pokemon with keys in their back. Really gruesome. Really gruesome.
And on the feature front, we have another Japan eShop roundup by Danny Bivens, in which we have hands-on impressions with Hiku Osu, the new eShop puzzle platformer by Intelligent Systems. And also we have...
Ooh.
Also, we have a blog from Danny as well. The Legend of Zelda 25th Anniversary Symphony Concert in Tokyo. Check out some pics from the event hall and of the program manual.
Finally, we've got a hiring announcement. We are now hiring a news writer and editor. So if you like news and want to write or edit about it, apply now. It's all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Alright, we are back, and it's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and if you're not by your computer right now, you can always go check the show notes, and there's a link there to send your own email. So, Greg has the first one.
Yes, Brood Wars from Orlando, Florida writes, "Do you think the rising number of video game conventions is good for the industry, considering all the time and resources both developers and the press have to devote to attending these conventions? Isn't that time for the developer better spent working on their game? As a consumer, I'm starting to long for the days where we only had to care about E3 and Tokyo Game Show. Now there seems to be a convention every few weeks, and the entire industry these days seems to stop for each and every one of them."
First off, it's often not the people actually doing the work on the games that are attending these. Typically
no,
not.
Right.
If they are, then they are focused. They're like stuff like GDC, where they're specifically focused on panels about what they are doing.
Typically, the
people that go to these are marketing execs, community managers, people like that.
In case of like some big E3 announcements, there may be developers on hand for the sake of interviews and things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Developers go to E3. There's no doubt. But they don't usually go to Gamescom. They don't usually go to Tokyo Game Show. They
don't, Gamescom, maybe if it's a European company. I mean,
they usually don't go to PAX. So,
but generally speaking, and just going to his point about, you know, he longs the days of just E3 and Tokyo Game Show. There's been a games convention in Europe for a decade now. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I logged for the days where there was one show you had to worry about, Space World.
There you go.
The thing with this is that the rational mind in me is, well, you would hope that companies could simply discern in some sort of economic fashion whether it is worth allocating whatever resources they do allocate to these. So, you know, if they think it's worthwhile, then who are you to argue, kind of thing. But, I mean, I suppose there are broader questions at play. And the problem is one of escalation and, you know, what is a sort of game theory types. Well, if they're doing it, then we have to do it. And everyone kind of gets drawn in almost against their will, you know, because they don't want to get sort of shouted down in the media cycle. And I guess that's the thing, because of the broadening of the media that covers games with online and all that kind of stuff, you know, there's just a lot more churn in the sort of media cycle for games now. And so that offers up the potential for more conventions and, you know, games being released at different times of the year that you want to focus on, you know, at various times you want to promote them at any opportunity you can to make sure they don't get buried. So, I mean, I'm sure these do serve a certain amount of a purpose in that sense. But, I mean, it's like there's probably a lot more televised presidential debates at the primary phase now because there's a lot more cable news channels to carry them.
And to sponsor them, to be honest.
Yeah, and to spot exactly where, and that's happened, you know, with the gaming media. It's just expanded, and it's kind of it's sort of a natural evolution of gaming as a whole industry, and everything that sort of satellite industries around it expanding and growing, you know, as the medium matures. So perhaps it's just an inevitable sort of thing. Now, in terms of whether real sort of, you know, valuable resources that could be put into the game are being spent here, I mean, first of all, there's a question of, you know, are we having specific demos being made for these?
Not for each convention. Usually there's one convention demo made per year. It debuts at E3, and then they carry it to all these other ones. Go to PAX in, what is it, September that they have it?
Yeah.
If you play games at PAX, unless it's like an indie game that's on a much tighter schedule, you're probably playing an E3 demo. And that game probably looks a lot different than it does in that demo, even if it comes out the week later. Because they're not going to make... It does take a lot of resources to make a new demo. And they're not going to do it. Because the E3 demo is already pretty polished and got good reception. And they can just send it out there with the same guy. And, you know, it's not a big deal. I mean, and it's good for these developers and these publishers. Because, you know, PAX is a public convention that anyone can go to. Anyone who's able to travel, basically, to the location, whereas E3 is closed off for the most part to the public, and it's much more difficult to get in. So for them, it's reaching a different audience the same product, so the cost to go is minimal, and the word of mouth and the potential exposure that they get out of taking it to one or two additional conferences is much greater than the cost to attend and support it. You know, and it's more chance to have interviews with media who weren't at E3 or who were too busy at E3, and now they go to PAX and there's nothing to cover, so they're more than happy to talk to you and get a more in-depth...
There is nothing to cover.
You know, so it's great, and I think these conventions are especially good for indie games, because E3 is not the place to show off your indie game that you're going to sell on Steam for $3.
No, because everyone's going to wait for 5 hours in line to play the next God of War game. So
yeah, so PAX is perfect for that kind of a thing. And, you know, Gamescom is great for some of these European-centric games, or just games that are a little bit behind in development schedule and can't get a good demo put together for E3. Sometimes they'll just hold it for Gamescom for the simple fact that it's 2 months later.
Well, yeah, and also the fact that, you know, there's game devs, in the UK, and all over Europe, who don't want to or can't afford to send people over to the U.S., so Gamescom is perfect for that.
Where they're going
to
get drowned out anyway.
And Gamescom, at this point, does attract the international media. So it's not like you're only going to get the European outlets there. Because, I mean, pretty much all the big websites send people. We sent people. Although, to be fair, they were already in Europe. It's not like we flew them there. But it's not like you don't get coverage now. It's a widely covered event. So you can make a sizable noise if you're there.
Yeah, and I think from the consumer's point of view, a show like Gamescom is not a big distraction because there's not going to be that much news that comes out of it. There's not much original coverage. So if you just don't want to hear the same stuff rehashed from the previous shows, I don't think you will. But who it matters to is the people who actually attend Gamescom. I mean, I think it hosts over 100,000 people.
Yep.
It has certain days that are open to the public. So if you're actually in Europe and you can actually go to Gamescom, then you really care about it, and you may not really mind that there aren't any real big announcements. I mean, what was the big story out of Gamescom this year? I couldn't tell you. I don't know that there was one.
Oh, I don't know. That budget PSP was pretty big news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you were there and you got to play games that, you know, maybe were shown at E3, but of course you couldn't get into E3 and it's across the world anyway, then I don't think you cared that there weren't any big hardware announcements or any big huge game reveals for the first time. You got to play these games, and, you know, if you're European media who can't go to E3, then you got to play these games and write coverage on them where you couldn't before. So it's valuable. You know, I think if people didn't see a value in it, they wouldn't support them. And that goes for publishers, developers, and the people who actually attend and the press who cover the events. Clearly, there is an appetite for this stuff. I don't think it's destructive. I don't think it's a bad thing.
We've even had, in the last couple years, events in Australia that are, you know, they're not news events, really, but they're a mix of marketing events and giving people a chance to play the game. And the event apparently was quite – first off, it's funded by a retailer, so there's a little bit of you know, there anyway, but it's well attended. It actually, I believe it covers its own expenses at least mostly. And the media does go there. It's something, if you're in Australia and you're in the enthusiast media, there's no way you're going to E3. It's exorbitantly expensive to get over here.
Yep.
And this is an opportunity to see these things. In that case, I mean, it's pretty late in the game, so they might actually be later builds, but they're probably just localized versions of the TGS build.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Or they're the builds that we see when we get invited to private media events.
And I mean, unless it's a really small game company, like I said, they're not pulling off their chief engineer on a game to go to these things.
I mean, in terms of the substitutability of resources, I mean, you tend to think this to what extent there are expenditures here, it's coming out of the marketing budget, probably.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
You could still say, well, you know, if you have so much money for a marketing budget, couldn't that money go to the development of the game or something? You know, there's some sort of substitutability argument there, but it's probably not. I mean, I obviously have no idea exactly how these things are allocated, you know, the sort of top level of publishers, but one would think, you know, the marketing budget is pretty sort of discreet from the development of the game.
Oh, yeah, yep. Definitely.
So, you know, I don't really see the money sort of flowing in at one and out of the other or whatever. So I think, you know, that's what they're probably looking at with in terms of, are these things worth our while? Is it, well, you know, you can buy a certain amount of ads and you could do, you know, this much typical coverage. But I think a lot of it now, the ones you're seeing stuff in the UK, Australia, all these, but where it's just more about getting that word of mouth rolling a bit more in advance than just when people buy the game. If, you know, a certain amount of people can actually get the chance to play it a couple months in advance or something like that, maybe they can, you know, help stoke some anticipation amongst their circle of friends, you know, beforehand. And certainly something, that kind of marketing, something Nintendo had a lot of success with getting people to try out the Wii for the first time and all that kind of, getting bloggers to kind of, you know, get all their people in their sphere of influence interested and all that. So I think it's just a modern marketing reality, and these conventions as kind of used as hubs from which a bunch of people could achieve the same thing at the same time.
So to further Greg's point of the discreteness of the budget of marketing and development, there are major game companies who I know them having said as such that before the very first design document of a game is written, there is a concept and they make a budget for development and they make a budget for marketing. This is how much we are going to spend on marketing this project.
Yep.
That money had no chance of ever seeing a cent of it fall into development.
Yep. And the bigger the game, the bigger the marketing budget.
And to that point, there is one game-based conference that has no reason to exist. And that is the Call of Duty one that Activision put on.
It was for charity, man.
No, it has no reason to exist. It is the dumbest concept.
Well, it says here Brood Wars is from Orlando, big convention town.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I think somebody might just be jealous that there's not a video game convention in Florida. And maybe there will be soon, you know?
Hey, there was one in Atlanta once for some reason.
Yeah, there used to be in Atlanta.
Hey, don't hate.
Hey, I went to a Cube Club in Atlanta.
Damn right.
I think John went with me, maybe. Can't remember if you were there or not, John.
Yeah, I went to that one. I'm assuming you were probably there with me.
but I avoided you.
It was a long time ago. Yeah. Cube Club. Hey, James has the next letter.
Paritosh writes, "Hi, Just wanted to know if you guys listen to video game music when not playing games. I recently heard music from a DJ named Efixia?
Looks like Efixa.
Spell it. E-P-H-I-X-A, for those of you wondering. And actually found myself liking it. I never thought I'd start listening to game music, but I'm enjoying it. If you do, any you can recommend?
Nope.
Well, there you succinct. For me, this falls into a wider bracket. There's two scenarios in which I'm listening to music. There's one where I'm just sort of listening to music because I want to listen to some, and then that'll generally be, you know, popular music to be as broad as possible about it. But then other times, I prefer to listen to instrumental music. Because, say, for instance, it's because I'm doing something else. So I want something that makes the experience seem a bit less sort of heartbreakingly mundane, but at the same time is not too distracting. Then instrumental music is a good way to go. And then there's a few ways I would sort of enjoy music in that situation. So you can go classical, you know, a bit of Chopin, something like that. Or you can go movie scores. I'm a big fan of that kind of stuff, especially the composer Angelo Badalamenti does a lot of David Lynch's films. That's nice. Very relaxing music in there. And then there's video games. There's some good stuff. Again, generally the more relaxing stuff. You know, I'm probably not going to crank up like Mega Man 2 or something.
Hey!
In that scenario.
Step off.
Even though it is still instrumental. But, you know, so certain aspects of like the Zelda soundtracks, all that kind of stuff. Quite a lot of stuff from Majora's Mask has that nice kind of surreal, relaxing kind of vibe to it. But if specific recommendations, there are also a few cases where I just really like a remix or an orchestrated version of something just because it like really brings the song to life. And one thing I think anyone should check out, probably that's listed, that you might be familiar with, I think probably 7 or 8 years ago, there was the Mario and Zelda Big Band concert. In
yes.
Japan. And
I have this. Billy bought me the copy of Famitsu that it came with.
Yeah, and I mean, specifically, the Dragon Roost Island theme from Wind Waker in that concert is amazing.
Which is so weird as a big band. But
it's so, yeah, exactly. You're not expecting that. And it's got this gorgeous, you know, the Celtic vibe is brought out all the way, you know, with the actual sort of fiddle going and all. It's brilliant. Yeah. It's absolutely gorgeous. If you can hear that song in your head right now from Wind Waker and imagine it being performed live by a band and all, and it's arranged and everything, it's fantastic. You have to track this down.
Not only can I hear it in my head, I can play it in my head.
He's recomposing it instead. So along those lines, OC Remix is a website that you should check out.
Yep.
And it's all sort of fan-made remixes of classic video game music, and a lot of it is really, really good.
There's a really good Metroid theme on there.
They've done like whole Super Metroid like remix projects, like
yeah,
the entire soundtrack as an album. And
yeah, their new thing are these, quote, albums, although they're not really albums, obviously.
Well, my favorite ever is the jazz version of the Super Mario Bros. 2 theme song,
yeah,
which is basically all big horns. And it's basically probably what was playing in Koji Kondo's mind when he composed that, and he just sort of had to break it down for the synth abilities of the Famicom and the Nintendo Entertainment System. But when you hear that, it's kind of shocking how well that works. And that's really fun for me, is like listening to the jazz versions of, because I think Mario doesn't quite get the credit it deserves for introducing an entire generation to jazz music. And if you've never heard much other jazz music, you might not realize that's what Mario music is. But going back to the very first Super Mario Brothers, those soundtracks are extremely heavily influenced by jazz, and in some cases are pretty much just jazz. And if you play it for a jazz fan who's never heard of Mario, they would think it was just good music. So I think that stuff's really fun. But Greg made a comment that I thought was really interesting, because you said you often will go to more like a more ambient or instrumental or kind of a low key thing to play in the background. And maybe that's why I don't do this very much. I don't listen to video game music outside of video games, because my favorite video game music is the kind that's really showy and fly. Like my favorite, like Mega Man music is probably some of
the
my
Flash.
Absolute favorite video game music. And if I was ever going to listen to video game music outside of playing the games, that's the stuff I would listen to. But that stuff's really distracting, and
yeah. See, that's the thing. I mean, I really love that kind of stuff in the context of the game, but it's just I'm less apt to listen to it separately.
Yeah. See, I have to take it a little bit old school. I have to go with Commodore 64 SID music.
Nice.
I love it. I love it. I actually, yeah, you can go on hvsc.com, I believe it is, and you can download pretty much SID files from every single Commodore 64 game
That's
out there.
That's a name drop right there, son.
Yeah, I love it.
So I'm probably the biggest person here for this, actually. I've got at least 5 or 6 game soundtracks on my MP3 player currently. I don't listen to them regularly, but they're in there. Usually I've got one that I just sort of loop through and listen to the songs, and subconsciously I just start to break down parts of it. I've talked to this before where when I listen to music, I basically tune into one part of the song, one instrument, and just sort of tune out everything else and just sort of subconsciously go through the song until I've pretty much picked apart all the pieces. It's a sort of like weird analytical thing my brain just kind of does in the background while I work on something else. But for me, it's kind of this mix of – so Johnny had brought up remixes, especially these jazzy remixes. One of my favorite video game quote albums is this official Phoenix Wright compilation that they rewrote all these songs as jazz songs. It's actually really, really good. Now, one of the songs is already a jazz song, so they basically cheated. But the rest of them are actually really, really creative in how they reworked these themes that are so intrinsically tied to the completely over-the-top approach of music the Phoenix Wright game has and turned them into these jazz melodies. It's a really creative and involving set of remixes that I actually can't listen to doing other things because I kind of just get into them a little bit too much. I would say that most recently – so I've gone through this weird kick where I had the last one I did recently was the Radiant Historia soundtrack, especially the piano remix that came with the game. And then to keep the Shimomura trend alive, after I got through Xenoblade, I actually went through and got that game's tag-along album. And I've actually listened to a handful of songs from there that I think are just have good melodies to them, and they just sort of serve as background noise to work. Primarily, their goal is to keep me from having to hear what's going on around me so I can focus on what I'm doing. Because otherwise I'll become distracted.
Yeah, I listen to a lot of podcasts to fill that void, and when I do listen to music, the thing is, a lot of the music that I like that's not video game music is kind of instrumental anyway, mm-hmm. or it has really long instrumental passages, so it's not really a big issue for me. There's not necessarily a practical need for me to use video game music to fill that space because I listen to other things that already do that. And I know you do too, James and yeah. Greg, but it's just not something that I would turn to. I wouldn't even think about it, about going to dig up some video game music to put on my iPod to listen to while I'm at work.
It's kind of weird because recently a lot of games that I've ended up with have come with soundtracks included.
I wonder why that is, James. Could it be your patronage of a certain publisher?
No, because it's 3 different publishers, actually. So, Salt Robo did. Like I mentioned, Radiant Story came with this excellent piano remix of a handful of themes from the game. And then Xenoblade came with a download soundtrack that you used a code to get mm-hmm. because they were too cheap to put it in the box. Unless you're in Australia.
Zelda is coming with a CD.
It is.
So that's yeah. pretty cool. It's like one of those things where I'm glad that they're doing it. I might listen to it once.
Actually, Ocarina of Time had that CD offer too. It's just been kind of a thing lately that more and more developers are making that music available, I guess is the best word to use for mm-hmm. it.
It's been done for a long time in Japan.
Yeah.
And it's becoming more of a worldwide thing now. It's interesting because it feels like, you know, CDs are kind of almost dying out and yet it's now we're finally actually getting, you know, game soundtracks in the West more. Not nearly as many as Japan, but
well
more.
I mean, as the case of Xenoblade, it was a download.
Yeah, and I will say I actually paid for the soundtrack to Super Meat Boy, which is really good, and I got a free download code for the Bit Trip Beat soundtrack, which is like 3 songs, but they're really good, and if I listen to more sort of techno type stuff, I would probably play that because it's just as good as any other, but I don't actually listen to that kind of music very often.
You know, it's not that I've just listened to any game music I've played. Now, one thing I did do, though, is as I work on a review, if I just need time to sort of sit with the game, I might pull up some songs from the game to sort of help me kind of remember what I was thinking while I played it.
That's a great idea.
I found that as I was working on the Salt Robo review, listening to the CD a little bit did help me sort of put myself back in the place I was as I played the game mentally.
Yeah, because it has that memory connection, right?
Yeah. It basically, when I start to go, how in the hell do I want to phrase this? I just sort of let it run for a little bit. I'm like, okay, I think I know where I want to be now.
Pro tip for all you young game writers.
It helps. It really does. I've done this for 3 or 4 games now, and it always seems to help.
Okay, well, thanks, Paritosh, and John has the next letter.
All right, the next one is from Joseph, a.k.a. Tepoudo. He writes, "Hello, everyone. Love the podcast. Thinking about all the things you've said in the past couple of episodes about smartphones versus handhelds like the 3DS really made me want to chime in and get your opinion. Nintendo won't see the success it has in the past with its handheld because of all the things Nintendo doesn't do or comprehend. The main focus being an online community and fully featured digital store that is consumer-friendly. I think your personal love for Nintendo games kind of blinds you to the cold reality of the gaming market. The average consumer doesn't care if it's an iOS game or 3DS game. They just want to be entertained, and if they can do so on a device they already use, it's a no-brainer thing to do. Nintendo needs a competent online component, community support, and a store that is well thought out and is easy to use. They need more competitive pricing. They don't have to be $1 games, but come on. Steel Diver for $40. Are you kidding me? We are in the age of access.
Are you kidding me?
Technology. Consumers want it quick and now. With solutions out there that offer this, Nintendo needs to step up and put their big boy pants on and act like an intelligent business, or they will have GameCube 2.0 on their hands."
Are you going through childbirth over there?
Sorry about that.
It's not really a question. I thought it was an interesting email, and so I wanted to read this out just to get Taputo's voice heard.
Yeah, we don't intend to spend very long on this because we've spent, as editor, I can confirm that we've spent plenty of more time than the listeners have heard. I assure you of that.
I would say, in fairness to us, we have stated explicitly that their online store needs to be better. Mm-hmm. And their stuff needs to be priced more competitively.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these complaints are very valid, and certainly ones that we brought up before. And I don't think any of us are championing Steel Diver as a plank of great value for the platform or something to launch it off of either. You know, there's plenty of valid criticisms in there, I think. But I mean, the one issue I would point is to, you know, obviously it says about being blinded by love of Nintendo and the average consumer doesn't care. But I mean, there's some, you know, in the end, there's only so much sort of power that Nintendo wields or so much respect that the name has or the brand commands or all that sort of thing. But, you know, if what Nintendo brings to the table didn't matter, all the people that bought a Wii would have been just as happy to buy the innumerable, number of alternatives that there were to stuff like Wii Sports Resort or New Super Mario Bros. Wii or all that kind of stuff. You know, but those are the games that sold millions and millions and millions of units because obviously they were well marketed and all that kind of stuff, but also because they are quality.
Yes.
And that is still something that Nintendo commands that I do not think has yet been replicated on smartphones yet. So I appreciate, you know, what he's saying. It's a valid point. And as I went through before, if people don't get into the Nintendo scene, they're not going to be able to appreciate what Nintendo brings to the table in terms of quality. And they won't know what they're missing. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, you can't just say, well, they don't care, you know, they'll just go with whatever's cheapest, because there's been plenty of cheap, inferior good alternatives on every Nintendo console going back to the NES that has not stopped people from buying the more premium-priced Nintendo games because they are fun.
It's interesting, in reading this letter, you know, on one hand, Taputo says that Nintendo basically can't compete with smartphones because people can get games on devices they already have. And then he goes on to say that here are all the things Nintendo needs to do to fix their online store and build a community or something. I would just say, for consistency's sake, if you don't think they have a chance because people already own smartphones and they can get cheaper games on it, why would Nintendo need to build a better online?
What difference does it make?
Yeah, exactly. That's not going to solve their problem. Their problem is a fundamental one of accessibility and having a separate dedicated device. So fixing friend codes, although great, is not going to fix the problem that you think is what's holding it back.
No, I mean, what that would be valuable as, one could argue, is a damage limitation strategy, is a very more effective way of getting more money out of the people that are going to remain with Nintendo. You know, if they feel like they're part of a community, if they've got a store which just makes it so bloody easy to give your money to it, where it's, you know, surprisingly difficult, as it's been in the current Nintendo stores, that they will just milk their existing base more effectively and therefore have a lesser loss of profitability from the smartphone situation, which I think is a valid concern for them because, as we've said before, I think it's pretty much inevitable that they're not going to be as successful as they were before in terms of just the mass scale of it. The winds are kind of blowing in the other direction. So the question is just how well they adjust to it. And I think some of the things that Joseph talks about are important adjustments they need to make. But on the other hand, they can't address the fundamental problem either.
No, but, you know, there are fundamental problems that smartphones can't address. And, you know, we've said a lot about how Nintendo needs to allow for cheaper games to be on their system for downloads. You know, you have to be able to have these $20 retail games like Brain Age was, that was a really breakout hit for DS. You're going to have that kind of thing happen on 3DS as well. But I think it's worth looking at the other side of the equation, also saying, you know, one of the limitations of smartphones as a platform is that you can't sell a $40 game on a smartphone. You could make a $40 game on smartphone, but you can't sell it, which means it won't be self-sustaining. Which means that you might make the first one, but you'll never make the second one because you lost your house making the first one and you're never getting it back. Right. So I think it is very valuable to maintain a piece of the market in which those premium games can actually thrive. Yes. And I don't know yet that 3DS is that platform. I don't know that a $40 game can thrive on 3DS. I think it remains to be seen. But it's certainly possible, whereas on smartphones, I don't think it's possible. I think that ship has sailed. You're not going to get a big premium multi-million dollar development production on a smartphone because you can't sell it for enough money to make it worthwhile. You have to make it small and cheap and easily digestible so that you can sell lots of copies of it at a low price point. And so I think it's worth having both. And the sad thing is Nintendo could actually have both of those on their own platform, and they're not doing that because they're, you know, they've got these pricing restrictions and, you know, retail distribution problems and things like that. But at least they are protecting the higher end of the market, and I think there are certain kinds of games that need that premium price point in order to exist. And there are kinds of games that I like to play. So I'm not blind to the situation, but I'm very glad that we're not down to just smartphones and that I don't think we're going to be anytime soon. Okay, the next letter is from Kevin in Kansas City. I'm a relatively new listener, but a big fan. It was recently announced that the pre-order bonus for Resident Evil Revelations is going to be a case for your 3DS. To me, this is evidence that America won't be seeing the slide pad attachment anytime soon. Why release a case that won't fit the system? I was curious to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, I wouldn't read too much into a pre-order item like that. First of all, I mean, you know, if you're going to carry your 3DS around with you, it probably isn't going to be with the attachment on. So probably not a whole lot of point releasing some jumbo size case for it.
Hey, I have a case specifically designed for the XL.
What is it, like a suitcase?
Yeah, I think Nyko will have you covered if you want to.
Yeah, it'll probably happen. I'm just saying, I don't think there's that much point in it. But I mean, to the issue of, you know, if and when this is going to come over, the first real significant sign that we've seen is Nintendo of Europe have taken up the role, as they've done on a number of occasions with recent Capcom games on their platforms, of a marketer and a distributor of Resident Evil Revelations, while Capcom remains the official publisher. But in their press release to go along with this announcement of that agreement, they actually discussed the fact that Revelation supports what they referred to as the slider pad. It's a very disturbingly confused terminology, but obviously they were referring to the Frankenstick or whatever you want to call it, the second analog stick, the second analog stick attachment expansion for the 3DS. So they've sort of talked about the fact that this game that's coming out in January of next year in Europe, you know, quite soon, supports it. So I would imagine that we will be getting it before that, or certainly close to it.
Yeah,
I don't expect them, however, in America or here, Nintendo, that is, to make a particularly big deal out of it.
No. But even in Japan, I don't think they're making a huge deal of it. Yeah, I mean, they had an entire press event like 3 days after this thing was revealed in Famitsu where they did not drop its name.
They didn't show it, they didn't talk about it, and the website.
So it's going to be out there for those who want it. And those who, you know, are interested in it, they're seeking information, they'll be able to find out about it, but they're not going to shout about it from the rooftops. That's already been demonstrated, so don't take any sort of quietness about this to be some sort of sign that it's going to be, like, months out or anything. It'll probably be pretty soon, but just kind of on the QT.
Now, I wouldn't be surprised if Nintendo eventually decides to push a game with it hard. But that they would probably only do that after they felt there was a critical mass of developers who are going to support the thing.
Yeah, maybe a bit of wait and see.
Like, I could see them saying, all right, let's put out a Zelda game that uses it.
I still think there isn't a Zelda game on consoles that uses two joysticks, really. I mean, in Wind Waker, you move the camera around, but you don't need to that much.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, I could see them just saying, all right, let's tack it onto a franchise and actually give this thing push now, a la, you know, Motion Plus.
I actually like this approach better than what they did with, say, Motion Plus, because Motion Plus is an interesting point of comparison. It was, they made a huge deal about it. Yeah, you know, it was like a tease before their E3 press conference. They said, we're going to announce this crazy thing that you can't even imagine. And then they showed it with really big games. They announced the Zelda with it, you know, and it was made a big deal of, and then it never really got the support. And I like the idea of putting out an accessory like this and letting the support bubble up from underneath without making a big deal about it. And if it becomes apparent at some point that consumers would, that this is something that people would benefit from having, then they can push it. There are already games that support it, and they're not just tooting a horn. You know what I mean? Like, I'm glad that they're not going to overinflate the importance of this thing, like they did for many other accessories before it.
Yeah, and I think what that also reinforces, though, is that there may well be cases, perhaps Kid Icarus, for instance, I mean, who knows,
please, God,
where people are going to say, this really should use it, and it doesn't. And you could look at that in even more egregious cases, like the DKC Returns not using the classic controller or things like that. You know, I mean, this is something that Nintendo does, so be prepared for more of it.
Yeah.
They gonna do what they gonna do.
I mean, that's kind of what I was saying, though. It wouldn't surprise me for them to make a call one day and say, yep, it's there, we should probably do a game ourselves that's big, and we discuss it.
But I'm okay with that. I mean, if you think about it, the expansion pack for N64 was released in a similar way where they never really had like a really big marketing push behind it.
Well, no, their push was to put it with every game that used it.
Eventually, but you have to remember that the first game that supported this was Rogue Squadron, which was a third-party game.
But Turok 2 was before that.
Yep.
No, Turok 2 came out, I think, 2 days after Rogue Squadron.
Oh, it was announced, split hairs here.
It was announced earlier, and in fact, Turok 2 is probably the reason that it came out at all, because the way expansion pack worked is that the N64 developer kit had that full 8 megabytes of RAM, because it sort of helped with debugging and, you know, tightening down. It sort of helped them keep up the frame rate before they got to the optimization part at the very end of development, that type of thing. It's typical for development kits to have extra RAM. And the guys at Iguana, some of whom later went on to work at Retro Studios in Austin, Texas, they said, well, we've gotten to where we could program this sort of extra so-called high-definition or high-resolution mode for Turok that uses this extra RAM that we've gotten used to working with in our development kit, and there's a place in the system where it could go. What if we just release a game with a mode supporting it, whether Nintendo puts the thing out or not? I mean, they basically made a pressure move where they leveraged Nintendo and they said, we're going to put this game out this way, whether you like it or not. So unless you want there to be this sort of stranded mode in the game that's totally unsupported by the hardware, then you'll have to release this thing anyway. And Nintendo said, you know, okay, well, in that case, we'll shoehorn it into our big Christmas release of Rogue Squadron at the last minute and get that working. Because, you know, Factor 5 is probably the same way. They're, you know, they're tech guys. They're really into that kind of a thing. So it's probably easy to convince them to throw that in there at the last minute. And it ended up becoming an official Nintendo-supported peripheral. But it all happened really quickly at the very last minute. And it ended up not supporting that many games. But I think people were generally not pissed off about the expansion pack on N64 because it's not like it was being shoved down your throat. You weren't being told that all the games you wanted to play, you had to have this thing. And the games that you really, really wanted to play, like the ones Nintendo put out, probably came with it anyway. And I think eventually that is what will happen with this slide pad attachment.
Perfect Dark is the only big game Nintendo put out that I don't think came with it. I know for a fact the Perfect Dark didn't. because they had that big sheet in front of all the displays telling you what you could do with and without it.
Anyway, I think the slide pad cradle for 3DS could come out only supporting third-party games. In other words, it could come out without a big Nintendo game to support it, be on the market for a little while. It would be sold by Nintendo, you know, and they would make a little bit of money off of it, but they wouldn't have to put a lot of marketing resources. If you wanted it, then you're probably the kind of person who had heard about it anyway, and you'd go seek it out. And then maybe next Christmas in 2012, if Nintendo has a game that they think would benefit from it, then they will pack one in. And if you've already got one, too bad. You're going to get a second one, which is what happened with me with, like, when Donkey Kong 64 came out.
Oh, yeah.
Well, now I got two expansion packs. I guess I'll give one to a friend.
I kept mine because I'm a bastard. Nobody gets my extra expansion pack.
Okay, well, Greg has the next letter.
Pluggerbugs writes, I have a question about the snafus of publishers. BlackRock Studio produced Split Second and Bizarre Creations made Blur, with Disney Interactive publishing the first and Activision the latter. I thoroughly enjoyed Split Second on PS3, while I completely hated Blur for what I felt like a quote-unquote grown-up Mario Kart. But both Disney and Activision opted to release the game in the UK at least on the same day, while both games had confusing marketing applied to them. Essentially, both games were shat on by their publisher. I liked Split Second. I bought the game. I recommend it to others who then bought it, and they enjoyed it too. I did not know anything about their next title, but was looking forward to seeing what came next. But what would you suggest for me to register my disappointment at the shitty business decisions of their publishers?
Yeah, we had to edit down this letter a bit, but suffice to say that both of these two developers have been shut down by their respective publishers.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, to be honest.
Yeah, pretty clear that these games being released, essentially, I think in the U.S. they were also released pretty much on the same day. They were similar games, sort of from slightly different angles. The marketing was not really there.
Their fates are intertwined in more ways than one.
And they probably cannibalized each other to the point where neither of them sold as well as they needed to. Both of these developers were shut down. Bizarre is the greater loss for my money because those guys made Geometry Wars 2, and I may never get Geometry Wars 3 now. So that is much more upsetting to me than whatever the fuck happened with Blur, which I don't give a shit about.
So it's funny he mentions the grown-up Mario Kart vibe because that was actually what their advertising campaign was.
Yeah.
And it always came off as kind of like smarmy in a bad way.
Yeah, like, who wants to play Mario Kart? It's for kids. Here's the mature version.
Yeah, like you can be smarmy in an ad and get away with it, but they didn't. Like, for them, it just sounded really dumb. It sounded like, this is a game for mature gamers, for mature systems, for mature people.
Well, I mean, I felt bad for BlackRock because they pretty much just the victims of their publisher just trying to completely get out of the AAA industry.
Yeah. I do think it was more that than, I mean, the sales of Split Second probably weren't great. They probably weren't good enough to make a sequel, but the real reason that studio was shut down is not financial issues. It was a strategic move by Disney to say, we don't want to make this kind of game anymore.
Yep.
Yeah, which is funny because they really hadn't gotten into that space until relatively recently.
Yeah, well, that was exactly it, right? Like, it was completely like a shift. They saw how much money was being made by all of these, you know, console games that cost a lot of money to make, but there was a lot in return. But, of course, what they didn't factor in was that there was a lot of risk involved. And as soon as they were exposed to that risk, they were like, screw this, we're going with Facebook games.
And to be fair, Disney is a very risk-averse company.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
They do occasionally do these really incredibly risky ventures. You're like, what the hell are you on? But by and large, as a company as a whole, they're incredibly risk-averse.
Well, they did, you know, they did put together Junction Point that made Epic Mickey. And despite bad reviews, it sold extremely well. And then they laid off half the company.
Yep.
And now I guess they're making like an HD version for Xbox and PlayStation. And I wonder if once they finish that sort of port, they're going to fire the rest of the company. I don't know that for sure, but I kind of suspect that. I wonder if they're really interested in making Epic Mickey 2 or if they're just going to try to squeeze a little bit more out of what they already did.
Yeah, I'd be skeptical at this point.
I mean, there's been more than a couple of different sources saying they are working on a 2, but, you know.
Should do Epic Goofy, right?
Well, as to the actual punchline here about what could the consumer do to register their disappointment about some of these sorts of decisions, not very much is the answer there.
Nothing. these companies don't give a shit whether you're upset about...
And furthermore, if their business decisions are shitty, by definition, surely that involves some sort of financial punishment of them, which would hope would be sort of more keenly felt by the decision makers there than, you know, letters from upset people.
I already didn't buy these two games, so I kind of already registered my apathy towards, you know, there's nothing you can do. Sorry.
You would think, you know, for instance, on the issue of, you know, did releasing games at a certain time, you know, hurt, you know, that's the kind of thing that they would have a post-mortem on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would have a certain amount of market research. And this sort of thing, you know, that they've got various feedback mechanisms inbuilt because it's in their commercial interests in terms of, you know, avoiding repeating a similar mistake. Now, in this case, it seems like their way of avoiding a similar mistake was to basically get out of the market altogether.
Yeah.
I don't want to be involved in a car crash. I'm going to walk everywhere.
Yeah, and of course, then there's a lot of collateral damage associated with that, which is why it upsets people, and I understand that. But ultimately, businesses that make bad decisions feel the pain. They just might not react to it the way you would hope.
I wouldn't be too worried about these guys. They'll find a landing spot somewhere, because Split Second is a relatively well-regarded game.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. I played it.
It was at about 100 press events, but once it finally came out, it seemed like it was the game we played at all these various events, and it seemed really good. And, I mean, to be fair, Disney gave it a hard marketing push at E3 that year. I mean, it was front and center in their booth. Like, the other crap was behind it.
Yeah, I think it was BlackRock that I read about where they were talking about how they were actually trying to pitch. They thought that they were good after they'd released that game, and they were actually trying to pitch other games, but they had no interest.
Disney's like, yeah, it's a great idea you got there.
There was no interest in whatsoever, so pretty much like they were like, hey, we have these games to pitch, and it went nowhere, and they eventually shut them down.
Yeah, just drop them in that bucket over there. It's a trash can. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, we'll take these documents, and we'll go and we'll burn them out back.
Is that a shredder? Thanks. What are you doing with those? No, it's a filing cabinet. Automatic. It's high tech.
Yeah, and I wonder if Disney just said, "Oh, you mean the success of this game can come down to a factor such as like what week we release it?"
Yeah.
Well, in that case, this is way too
some other douchebags put out a game.
Way too unstable of an industry.
You know, we discussed this a while ago now, but there was I can't remember what the three games were, but there was a date in which three separate fighting games all came out for the 3DS.
Yeah, and then that did get resolved, essentially.
It did, because two of them got delayed.
Yeah, I mean...
But the only games scheduled to come out for the 3DS that day were all fighting games. It's like...
It was ridiculous.
Although, as we've said before, the 3DS in November is getting chock-horrific. And there's one you can actually add to the list in Europe. It's not in America. It's Tales of the Abyss. It's coming out this year, whereas in America, they're pushing it further out into that window that Johnny talked about last week, which might be more appropriate early next year. So,
I'm really looking forward to that game, though. I'm excited. I mean,
Namco Bandai America looked at the schedule and went, what the fuck? No!
There is one thing that came out recently, sort of another one to add to the cram in America, is Nano Assault is coming out in November.
Oh, really? That game was incredibly impressive at E3.
Really?
Really, really fun, but graphically, holy shit, you will not believe that game runs on 3DS when you see it. It is fucking amazing. And really interesting gameplay, and it was really fun to play. So, and the music will be fantastic. I mean, it's shining, so the music will be really hot, too.
That is a suicide slot to be in, though.
I do worry, but hopefully, you know, they're just going to stick around on the shelves. You know, that's the real issue, is how long are the retailers going to stick with a lot of this stuff? You know, if they even give it much space to begin with, for the opportunity, once people have played, you know, 3D Land or whatever, to actually move on. I mean, this cannibalization thing is a real issue.
But, you know, I don't think those Nano games have ever really sold all that well. Iridium, which it was before. I think Shinen must make those games for next to nothing, and Majesco seems perfectly happy to keep publishing them. So they must have really, you know, like really low break even numbers on those games.
Oh, I assume so, but still.
I would say, like, if you're looking for a really cool, like, exclusive 3DS action game, Nano Assault is definitely one to keep your eye on. I can't wait to play more of that.
But so if don't you think if you're in that sort of area where, you know, you don't need to sell many copies, just like a significant amount to cover yourself, you're probably better getting out of the really busy time and putting
yeah.
it in a...
Yeah,
It is a questionable decision on the part of the publisher, in my view. But
let me put it to you this way. If you're a publisher right now and you have a game you want to put out this year, don't. Just don't.
And a lot of games, you know, the Billy calls it Second Christmas and all that, you know, the games that get kicked out because it's like, well, it is really crowded. Like, we don't want to go up against that. And we could still get it in this year's financials because it'll be before the end of the fiscal year. So let's put it in January, February, March. You know, there are a lot of publishers that are making that decision these days. And I think that's prudent.
It is kind of funny, though, that Namco Bandai Europe and Namco Bandai North America just made totally different decisions. Like you know it's not a localization issue.
Yeah,
because
right.
It's probably being localized in North America. So it's just like...
Well, isn't it already done from the PS2? I presume they're just using the same one.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's probably them just going like... Mm-mm.
There'd be more localization work probably for the European version.
Oh, there's an executive on one side of the ocean or the other sweating bullets on this one.
Well, I mean, one of the big ones, I think, is going to be Sonic versus Mario. I mean, is that wise on the part of Sonic Generations?
Nothing that Sega does on behalf of Sonic is wise.
That's not true. Mario Sonic at the Olympics is apparently a very wise decision.
Not on 3DS.
Jesus, that game is bad.
It's fun because, you know, a lot of people have very good things to say about the 3DS version of Sonic Generations.
Oh yeah,
You know, and they've got a good pedigree with the DS. You know, still, you know, the people did Colors and Rush and stuff for Dibs on DS. You know, it's a continuation of that, but obviously they're kind of piggybacking off what they're doing with the whole anniversary thing on the HD consoles too. So I guess that's why it's coming out at the same time, because the HD game's coming out and they want to, you know, the marketing kind of spill over. And all. But still, I mean, you're going head to head with 3D. Like, I think that's a bad idea.
Oh, it's so bad. It's moronic. What's amusing to me is that they're going to get killed and Sega will almost certainly come to the wrong conclusion. They needed more friends. That's why people didn't buy
the game.
Yeah,
the wrong conclusion is let's make another Sonic game next year. give it a year off, please. Give it a year off. Let it rest. Rethink your strategy. Spend a little more time and money on the game.
Sega might be the champions of coming to the wrong conclusion, if I think about it.
Well, to bring it back around to the original question, I mean, there's plenty of people that have been expressing their displeasure with Sega's questionable business decisions for several years, and you see the difference it makes. So I would advise Bugabugs to let it go.
That's right.
Yeah, just look the other way.
Let Sega do what it does, because they're too dumb to listen to you anyway.
Well, the good thing is, you know, the people who made this game that you really like, Split Second, at BlackRock, although their company is gone, those people probably still want to make video games, and they're probably working at other companies now. And, you know, it may be difficult for you to follow that thread and find out where those people go, or it may be difficult for you to see their influence in games at other companies, but the talent that you appreciated and the inspiration... It has not vanished from the earth just because that company name no longer exists and because that office is...
They didn't literally fire the company.
Yeah, they didn't burn it down. I mean, those people are probably still making video games. So, you know, if you really care, find out their names and try to, you know, look them up and see what they're doing now. But talent is rarely lost from the industry. It just gets shuffled around a lot. And, you know, it sucks that those people might be out of work for a few months or that they might end up going to work on a game that they don't think is, or that you don't think is worth, you know, is worthy of their skills. But, eventually they probably will. Eventually they'll probably come back around to making another game that you really like. So I wouldn't get too down on it. You know, it's all, we're talking about like corporate mismanagement and stuff. And, you know, and at the end of the day, you still got Split Second. So you still got a game that you love. Be happy about that, because it's much worse when a really promising game is canceled and never comes out at all.
Yes.
Okay. James has the last letter.
Cal writes, with it being 4 years after the release of the biggest success using the Honesty Box model, Radiohead's In Rainbows, I found myself thinking a lot about whether that kind of payment type has a place in the video game industry. Obviously, in Radiohead's case, the fact that they're Radiohead practically ensured the experiment's success, but with games, there hasn't been too much experimentation in the field. Indie games like World of Goo have tried it, but only long after it had become a massive success. Really, I feel like before writing this off as a no- novel publicity stunt for those who can afford to take the risk, it would be interesting to see new and original games from larger publishers to try this approach and really see if this kind of innovation has any weight in the video game industry. What are your thoughts on such a change, and could you ever see it working out?
It has happened, actually. It is mostly like PC indie games, but not necessarily long after they come out. Some of them do it right off the bat. There are brand new PC games that you can pay whatever you want, whatever you feel is appropriate. The Humble Indie Bundle is a really good example of this, that they sort of split the money between a charity and the developers who made the games, and you can pay whatever you want. You get like 5 or 6 indie games altogether. Sometimes they're brand new. Sometimes they'll even throw in a bonus game that's not even finished yet, so you kind of are buying the rights to play it once it does come out, you know, a month later. So these are not necessarily crusty old games that aren't really worth anything anymore. They're games that, you know, to the people who made them might mean eating. You know, it could, you know, could be a big deal, and they think this is a good marketing strategy for them to get their name out there and to make some money off of it. So it does happen. I don't think you're going to see it happen from a big publisher, because how do they sell that to the investors? You know, how do they convince their board of directors to, I mean, Radiohead did it because they own their own record label and they don't really have to answer to anyone for that, for the sales of that record. So they can make that big risky decision and say, you know, we don't care if this is crazy, we're going to do it. I don't think you see many like big AAA type video games that are in that position. Maybe Valve.
So I know that Valve has already gone to the free-to-play model, and they've begun implementing it in other games.
Yeah, and free-to-play is kind of a twist on this idea.
That's
kind
of where I see big publishers going with it.
Yeah, it's not completely different. I mean, it is basically, you can play this game for free if you want, or you can give us some money. And the experience will be different in those two cases, but we're still giving you the choice. And that's a choice that in the past you haven't had. I don't think that model works for everything, but for Dota 2... why not?
Yeah, I mean, they have essentially expanded the Steam platform with a lot of free-to-play functionality. So you could see a lot of games coming across Steam that have that built into it.
Yeah, and I want to take this opportunity to highlight a game that almost went down this route. I was reading on Gaff last week that I think his name's Jason Wishnov. He's a poster on Gaff, and he made the game Sequence that I talked about earlier in the year that I really liked. It's basically an RPG with rhythm game battles, and a really good story that it's kind of like an American take on The World Ends With You. Really, really interesting game. It was only on Xbox Live Indie Games, and this guy started making a PC version, and he submitted it to Steam, and they were taking a really long time to get back to him with an answer on whether they were going to allow it to be on Steam. And while he was waiting on that, some people were asking him, you know, if that didn't happen, what was he going to do? And he said, maybe I'll just throw it up on my website and let you pay whatever you want. You know, so he must have thought that that was possibly financially viable. Anyway, it did end up getting selected for Steam, and I think it's up there now. If it's not, it will be soon. So I just want to take this opportunity to promote Sequence, because now it's on Steam. It's still not available for Mac. It's only for PC. But if you didn't have a 360 and you couldn't play it before when I talked about it, now's your chance. Go check it out on Steam. I think he's selling it for like $4 or something like that. It's a fantastic game. It's easily one of my favorite games that I've played this year, and I would really highly recommend that you check that out.
Yeah, a few things I wanted to bring up here actually just related to Radiohead's experience with this, because I think it's quite instructive as to how viable it might be in the future for things. For instance, their follow-up album that came out earlier this year did not use the same model, for instance. So that perhaps tells you something. But in terms of what did happen in 2007, 2008, when they went with the Honesty Box thing on their website first, and then the CD came later. So apparently 60% of the people that downloaded from the site didn't pay anything for it at all. And the average was about just shy of £3. That is a global average, but in pounds. So, you know, not a lot. But to be fair, the basic tenets of economic theory would suggest that everyone would take it for nothing. You know, so it's still kind of amazing that more than a third of people actually did feel moved to pay for something. And I think some of that is related to the fact that, you know, as kind of Cal intimates here, you know, the kind of cachet that Radiohead have, the kind of following they already have. In many ways, you could argue that people are almost paying for the enjoyment that they've already had from Radiohead. You know, they probably, you know, if they bought something like OK Computer for a tenner, and that became one of their favorite albums ever, and they got a lot more than £10 enjoyment out of it, they probably feel like, yeah, you know, I'll pay for this when I don't have to, because it's all gravy, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's like they're just paying for the cause, really. They're just contributing to the cause.
Well,
yeah.
And let me give you a little different spin on that story, Greg, because in my case, I had a friend who downloaded the album when it was Pay What You Want. I think he told me he paid like $5 for it, something like that, and played it for me in the car when we were on a trip. And I heard the music and liked it, but I never went and bought it. I think the period where it was available like that had already ended, maybe.
Right.
Or maybe I just never took the initiative to go find it. You know, it wasn't a priority. But 6 months later, I'm in a store right before Christmas, and I see that it's on sale for like $8 or something like that. And I ended up buying the CD of In Rainbows because I'd heard the music from someone. So I think it ended up helping with word of mouth as well. And then when they did a legit retail release later, people like me, who I'm totally savvy enough to go to a website and download music, I just never bothered. But because I'd heard the music, when I did see it in retail, I thought, I want that. And it ended up becoming one of my favorite albums for a long time, actually. And I listened to it a hell of a lot. And did I feel silly that I bought a CD of something that was essentially free on the internet with the band's permission? Not really. I never really felt bad about it because I still felt like I only paid $8 for this CD, you know? I still felt like I got a good deal and I got more than my money's worth of enjoyment out of listening to it over and over and over again. So I was totally fine with that. And that I might never have bought that CD. I certainly didn't buy their next CD. You know, I might never have bought that if they hadn't have put it up on their website in the way that they did. So,
well, the CD, at least in the UK, you know, went to the number one in the album charts. It's not like
it didn't exactly hurt them, did it?
There's perhaps some evidence as a backup that, you know, maybe it contributed sales in other ways. But I think the point is that for, you know, I think where it might be the most viable is where you've got a situation where you can almost get people to pay, you know, because they feel like, you know, they're already in surplus with this particular developer. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah, you know, say for instance somebody like Nathan Fett's Bobby's Best Games, you know, like on a small scale. You know, if people have played a bunch of his indie games and they feel like, you know, I paid, you know, however, I mean, they're pennies on, aren't they? Like Weapon of Choice, are they really cheap?
Yeah, yeah, they're insanely cheap. I mean, Shoot One Up is $1.
I could imagine if he put up a game in an honesty box way, a lot of people would say, you know, Weapon of Choice would have been worth $20 to me or whatever. So, you know, I'm having paid so little for previous games, I'd be willing to pay something even when I don't have to for a particular game, you know. But I think that's kind of what it kind of reminds me of when sports teams pay aging stars a contract extension. It's really for what they already did, not what they're going to do. It's kind of like that. You have to already have that kind of build up, I think, for it to be really successful. The other way of doing it is World of Goo, where it's kind of like, well, we've already sold what we're going to sell. So we could just do this to like skim the people off the bottom that wouldn't do it any other way. I mean, I think the average on that was like $2. So it wasn't nothing.
Right.
But they're getting it from people who otherwise would have given them $0.
Exactly.
So they figure, well, we got nothing to lose. An interesting thing that since you brought up Nathan Fouts, you know, former guest on the show and sort of a friend of the show, you know, he recently got a publishing deal and put out Serious Sam Double D on Steam. Which I'm still playing. It's longer than I thought it would be. It's really good game. I mean, as John and I noted, it's pretty much Weapon of Choice 2. Mm-hmm. It's really good, except you don't need an Xbox to play, and it'll probably run on damn near any computer, I would think. It's a 2D sprite game. It's really, really fun. It costs like $7. I mean, it's still cheap, but it's certainly his most expensive game that he's put out yet. And yet, apparently, people have been pirating it. And I saw him put a post up on his blog, on Mommy's Best blog. and he was saying that they have some kind of metrics to show that apparently Serious Sam Double D has been very heavily pirated. And instead of getting really angry about it and lashing out like a lot of developers do when they find out that their games are being pirated, he said, you know what? If you've pirated the game already, do me a favor and play it.
And if you like it, consider donating a couple of bucks my way. You know, if you would have never bought this game for $7, but you downloaded it, paid nothing, and then decide and then played it and discovered that you actually really like it, here's a PayPal link. I would appreciate it if you sent me a couple bucks. And I've never seen someone ask pirates for a donation. And I don't know if it worked, but I thought, man, that is a really interesting approach.
It's like, why not?
I mean,
what the hell?
Because you're not going to stop the piracy. So again, you've got nothing to lose, right? From these pirates, they've given you nothing. You're not going to stop it.
You know, honestly, I think pirates may actually appreciate and respect the fact that they're actually being kind of like,
catered to.
They still give him any money, but they'll appreciate the fact.
He's not lashing. He's not freaking out about it. He's not calling them dirty, evil, nasty people. I mean, and I think Nathan is very smart. I think he knows that the people who pirated that game probably never would have paid for it in the first place.
So actually,
and a lot of them will probably never play it. Like, there are people who pirate games by the boatload, and they never actually get around to playing them. So I think it's interesting that he's saying, you know what, if you pirated this game, I'd appreciate if you actually played it. Let me know what you think and consider donating some money.
So I have a better example, and I believe it was World of Goo, but I don't remember if that's a game or not. But the game went up. It originally went on sale, and then it went to this pay whatever you want, including zero, and the game was still getting pirated.
Yeah, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence about, you know, people just torrenting in rainbows when you could just get it from the site. I mean,
it's like, and they put up a blog post basically saying, guys, the game is free. Why are you pirating it?
Because these pirates don't follow the news about the game and they don't know that it's free.
Yeah.
It's easier for them to just go ahead and get it along with the five other games they were going
to
pirate.
But then you
right?
had to get a crack for it and you had to go through all that garbage. It's like, you could have gotten this for nothing before and done it way easier.
Yeah.
Your time is apparently worth negative money to you. Congratulations.
Well, at least it saved the developer on bandwidth.
That was I think the blog post made that joke. Well, at least we don't have to pay for your bandwidth.
All right. Well, that's the final email this week. You can send your letters to us rfn@nintendoworldreport.com or head over to the show notes at the website and you'll find a link there.
It's the website, people.
It's the website. So, before we go, I want to plug a little podcast called NWR Connectivity. It's in its fourth episode by the time you hear this, I think. They've got some really cool ideas. I appreciated the segment recently where they did NWR Jeopardy. They had a couple of staff members on there, and they pretty much played Jeopardy, except all the questions were about video games. And it was really fun. And they'll probably revisit that a little bit later and go back to it. I believe episode 99 of Radio Trivia will be out either by the time this show comes out or very soon after. I think it's in editing right now, so.
In post. Get it right, Johnny. This is the industry,
oh,
man.
Oh, sorry. Yes, it's in post. It's getting ready for its cume. It's my other Hollywood insider term. But anyway, Radio Trivia 99 is coming out very soon, and we are getting ready to record episode 100.
The Terradome.
So I should be on that. I'm really looking forward to it. Radio Trivia is very dear to my heart, and I think everybody listening to this should go check it out. It's a super fun show, especially if you enjoyed our conversation earlier about video game music. Dude, we give you a whole bunch of it on Radio Trivia, so in a really fun format. Definitely go check that out. And now it's time to announce the winner of the Retroactive Poll. And I assume most of you listening to this do not know the winner yet because you didn't vote in the poll.
You bastard.
Yep.
So it's worth doing the announcement. Winning with nearly 40% of the vote. It was pretty close all the way across, though. I was very happy with the distribution of the voting. I thought we put together a nice, even-handed slate of games, and it did turn out that way. So I'm happy to see that. And I thank everyone who did vote. Please tell your friends next time. But River City Ransom won the vote with about 39%, and that is the game we'll be playing. Probably kick it off in a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks from now, I'm not sure, but it won't be too long, so there's plenty of time to check it out. It is on the Wii Virtual Console for about $5, depending on where you live. I think it is available worldwide, so this is a game that we should be able to get a lot of participation on. It's also certainly is fun. I've played it before. I've talked about it on the show a couple years ago. It's really fun to play by yourself, but if you can get a friend to do some co-op, it is very famous for having a really fun co-op. I am going to try to arrange that for myself since I've already played it as a single-player game. I'm going to try to go back and do it as co-op. So you might want to keep that in mind if you have someone around who can play it with you. But it's a really cool game. It's kind of like a mashup between Double Dragon and like a very basic 8-bit RPG. It's a really interesting, like you go into shops. The translation is hilarious. The game has a lot of character. And it's not super long either, so I think it's going to be very digestible. We'll probably do it in a single week here on the show, but I think it'll be fun to talk about. So if you've never played it before, consider giving it a shot. It's cheap, it's easy to get to, and of course there will be a forum thread by the time you hear this where you can go and register your thoughts or questions about the game, and we will be picking excerpts from that forum thread to read on the show when we discuss the game. So be sure to go by, play the game, go by and check it out, and then next time, vote on Retroactive, okay? I'll be out next week, but these guys will hold down the fort, but be sure to tune in each and every week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
That was a hard start right there. Man.
Yep, here we go again, Johnny.
God damn it. Another fucking podcast.
Yep,
Jesus.
Another podcast.
Can't you people just listen to last week's again? God.
Week after week after week.
Not you, John. Not technically. I mean, well, you, it's more like week after week after. Eh.
I get more than enough. I think I speak for the whole podcast when I say that.
This is all your fault, listeners.
We got fans. We got to satisfy them. It's the way it is. It's a symbiotic relationship, you know. I disdain, but however.
How is it symbiotic? What do we get? Are we getting paid? I mean, if they want to start paying, that's fine.
I'd be fine with that. I mean, I wouldn't have any problems with
John. John needs the scratch anyway, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, I need the Skrilla. You know, my brother got to eat.
Well, yeah, obviously. But that's not what I think that money gets used for.